Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, January 4th. You've been hearing on the news a few of the same clips, I think, over and over, of the hour-long phone call that President Trump had on Saturday with Georgia election officials, right? Republicans in a Republican-run state. Mostly, you've probably been hearing the one of Trump asking them point blank to find 11,000 votes so they can say that he won. But the tape and transcript of the full phone call exist, and I want to start by playing just a couple of other very short clips than the one or two you've been probably hearing. These are just to give you examples of the way the Georgia election officials gave the president specific answers when the president brought up specific claims of massive voter fraud that they had already debunked. So, for example, here is a specific claim by Trump. We'll hear Trump first, about a video that he says shows a massive example of voter fraud in the form of ballot stuffing as he addresses Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger.
Let's face it, Brad. I mean, they did it in slow motion replay magnified, right? She stuffed the ballot boxes. They were stuffed like nobody's ever seen them stuffed before. So there's a term for it when it's a machine instead of a ballot box. But she stuffed the machine. She stuffed the ballot. Each ballot went three times.
So that's the claim. Here's Raffensperger's response.
You're talking about the State Farm video, and I think it's extremely unfortunate that Rudy Giuliani or his people, they sliced and diced that video and took it out of context. So the next day we brought in WSB TV and we let them see the full run of tape. And what you'll see, the events that transpired are nowhere near what was projected by,
And at that point, Trump cuts him off. But there was that very specific response about Giuliani editing a tape to look like something it wasn't. And the Secretary of State of Georgia showed the full tape to an Atlanta TV station, which has, tape viewing equipment. And the Giuliani edit was debunked. Specific claim specifically refuted in that exchange with the president. And here's one more. Trump made a claim about thousands of dead people voting in Georgia. Here again is Brad Raffensperger responding to that.
I guess there was a person named Mr. Raynard that came to these meetings and presented data. And he said that there was dead people, I believe it was upward of 5,000. The actual number were two. Two people that were dead that voted. And so that's wrong. That was two.
So there are just two examples of how the Georgia election officials, Republicans, led by Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger there, had investigated the claims of massive voter fraud and had the answers to them. And all the president could do was claim over and over again that he had better evidence that they would present sometime in the future. So I thought you'd like to hear those clips as examples of how specific the responses were. And of course, the spectacle will continue for at least another few days as Congress is scheduled to certify the election results on Wednesday, and some Republicans in each House will object on the basis of claims like the president was making. But that spectacle, hard as it is to look away from, is only a distraction from the people's actual business that's taking place right now, too, at the height of the pandemic, including Congress overriding Trump's veto of a defense spending bill and Mitch McConnell refusing to allow a vote on a $2,000 per person stimulus check for Americans making up to $75,000 that would probably pass the Senate if there was a vote. Of course, President Trump was for that, too, and almost didn't sign the coronavirus relief bill as a result, but it was Trump and the Democrats in that case, and that conversation is ongoing. And on the Democratic side, the House barely reelected Nancy Pelosi Speaker yesterday after the Democrats lost seats in the November election, and they have their internal debates too. With us on all this, and maybe even more, is Democratic Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill from Northern New Jersey, one of the House freshmen from the relatively moderate wing of the party, who did retain her seat and as of yesterday became a House sophomore. For those of you who don't already know her background, Mikey Sherrill graduated from the United States Naval Academy and flew missions as a pilot around Europe and the Middle East, as well as being a Russia policy expert. She also got a master's in economic history from the London School of Economics and a law degree from Georgetown. Besides serving in the Navy, she was a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Jersey before being elected to Congress. Congresswoman Sherrill, always good to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC and Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you, and thanks for having me.
Do you want to respond first to the president's phone call in any way?
Yeah, you know, this is, I think many of us have been concerned for many months, most of my term, that the president would not accept the free and fair election results. So last spring, we held a hearing in the House Armed Services Committee where I questioned the Secretary of Defense and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff about their responsibilities in a peaceful transition of power. You know, this is when we had seen the president really misusing the Insurrection Act and trying to put military troops on the streets. They came to the border. He had called them to the border of the district. And I think the SecDef and the chairman kind of talked him down from actually using military troops. There were guardsmen and there were law enforcement, but not federal military troops. So I questioned them about their responsibilities under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, under our statutes, and importantly, under the Constitution. And they both strongly said that there was no place for our military in a political election and deciding who the president was. But this was, you know, so this is something we've been seeing. And then the president further made further remarks about how he wouldn't accept any sort of turnover. And since that time, we've seen him again and again and again trying to use any and every way that he can think of to overturn a democratic election. It's really shocking to have a president of the United States trying to undermine our democracy like this. And that phone call is chilling. I don't think it's surprising. You know, we've heard reporting of screaming matches in the White House when the, you know, president was, you know, and close advisors talking about using military troops to rerun the election. We've seen the members sign on to, you know, in the House sign on to amicus briefs, you know, sort of trying to bring a case without merit to turn over the election. But, you know, so this is what the president's been doing. But it really, I think what we saw here, which I thought was impressive, was the Secretary of State refusing in real time to adopt any of these kind of conspiracy theories or claims that don't have evidence to back them up, you know, and he, you know, as you played those tapes, had done his research and again refuted the president's claims.
For you as a lawyer and a member of the House, can you explain to our listeners what happens on Wednesday under the Constitution and the law?
Yeah, so, you know, for your listeners, they're probably, as they've heard more and more about January 6th, as Congress certifies the election, kind of thinking to themselves, well, what has happened in previous elections? And usually this is something that is sort of a pro forma session. We meet, the election is certified in about a half an hour. And what happens is the vice president, as the president of the Senate, oversees the certification. Both houses meet, the House and the Senate meet to certify the election. And there is really a roll call of each state in alphabetical order, and the electoral college votes are presented, and then they are certified. If anyone wants to challenge them, you have to do so in writing, and in order for that challenge to be debated, you have to have at least one member of the House and one member of the Senate. And then, if you have that, a written challenge by at least one member of the House and one member of the Senate, then both houses will separately debate for no more than 2 hours the merits of the challenge, and then come back and vote on whether or not to certify the electoral count. So that's why you had heard, I think, Mitch McConnell really trying to quell the members of the Senate from saying that they would adopt what some of the members of the House have been saying, that they were going to challenge these votes.
And so what do you anticipate in this two-hour floor debate? Do you think it'll be a back and forth, making and refuting specific claims of fraud, like we heard in the back and forth between the president and the Georgia Secretary of State in those clips?
I think what you'll see are several things. I think each person, each member can speak, but no more than two hours. I think you'll see members, especially members from the states that are being contested, of course. Each member can speak for 5 minutes, and it'll go back and forth, you know, a Democrat and then a Republican. And I think what you'll see is the evidence of why the secretaries of state or whomever in the state certified the elections, why we as the American public can be sure that these elections were run well. And I think you'll also probably see a discussion about how we came to these values, what our democracy is based on, and why it's so critical that we support these elections and that we have Congress certify this election.
And most people, I think it's fair to say, are rolling their eyes at this whole thing and saying, please, we have real problems like the pandemic, the disease, how many people are dying, the hospitals filling up, and the economic impact. Congresswoman, did you vote for the compromise coronavirus relief bill? And are you for the $2,000 checks that Senate Majority Leader McConnell is refusing a vote on?
So, yes to both. I was happy to vote for the compromise bill. What we have to understand in this country is we need to continue to legislate in Congress. And sometimes that means we legislate on bills that I am 100% in agreement, and sometimes that means we legislate and vote for bills that I think could be better, but do support concerns I have and support the American people. And that's what this was. Do I think we need state and local funding? 100%. This is not the time to be cutting teachers and police and firefighters as we're facing this pandemic, as we're trying to get our kids educated during really, really trying times. However, was it critical that we extended the eviction moratorium so we didn't see people being thrown out of their homes right after Christmas? Yes, I believe it was. I think it was important that we had more PPP loan money because in my district, we have small businesses who made use of the PPP loans, and yet they've run out of money, and we've got to get them through the winter because it's so critical that if we are going to get through this pandemic and not have severe economic harm at the end of it, we have to have our businesses intact. We can't have every shop on Main Street shut down. We have to make sure that we're keeping them going as best as possible so that people can return to work as soon as it's safe to do so. As far as the $2,000 stimulus checks, did I think that it was the right way to govern, to kind of sit on the sidelines and refuse to say a number during the whole negotiations? And believe me, Brian, these negotiations have been going on for months. I mean, we passed the HEROES Act in May, the House's version of what we thought the second round of relief should be. So these negotiations have been going on for months, and it was really not until we were kind of ready to ink the deal that the president suddenly weighed in with this. I think to add to the chaos that he seems to crave and to try to upend this. However, I think the $2,000 would be very helpful to people right now and would really help spur, again, the economy, because much of this money goes directly into the economy as people spend it to try to keep going during the during this crisis.
And so this is likely to come up again after President Biden is inaugurated, and especially if the Democrats win control of the Senate. But I want to play you a clip of McConnell and his argument against the checks would go to people with income up to $75,000, receiving the full $2,000, and then phase out gradually to zero once you get to $99,000 of income per person. Nevertheless, here is McConnell from Thursday characterizing those checks as socialism for the rich.
Now, for several days, we've heard some senators say Congress must send more cash to high-earning households who haven't seen any income disruption during COVID-19. Our colleagues who purport to be the champions of vulnerable Americans now say that what struggling people really need is for Congress to stop focusing on targeted relief for them specifically and to instead send thousands of dollars to people who don't need the help. Experts from across the political spectrum agree that our colleague from Vermont is dead wrong on this. Socialism for rich people is a terrible way to help the American families that are actually struggling. So let me say that again. Borrowing from our grandkids to do socialism for rich people is a terrible way to get help to families who actually need it.
And, of course, reference to his colleague from Vermont was to Bernie Sanders, who's been a leader on that question. So, Congresswoman, you have a degree from the London School of Economics. One, are people in your district who make $75,000 a year rich, as McConnell characterizes them? And can you think of examples of actual socialism for the rich that Mitch McConnell and his caucus support?
Well, Brian, you know, you're well aware of the area, and I don't think anybody in my district who makes between $75,000 and $99,000 a year would regard themselves as rich. I think they would regard themselves as middle class. But I don't think any of those people would regard themselves as rich. And certainly when we're thinking of who the wealthiest are, those are the people that this administration and McConnell have given tax cuts to and have really supported. I'll also say that, you know, it's frustrating because I know that sometimes there are these phrases repeated over and over and over again, and we've got to delve into what we're actually talking about. And saying that experts across the political spectrum disagree with us, well, there's, you know, I get a sense that if this was put on the floor of the Senate, it would pass. And so, you know, saying that experts across the political spectrum disagree with us is simply untrue. I've spoken to economic experts across the political spectrum, and their assessment, and these are economists left, right, and center, including some people in this administration, who have said, the worst thing we did, you know, when we were trying to, under Obama, get out from under the last huge recession, we stopped spending too early. And even though, you know, many of us are, of course, always concerned about the amount of spending of the government and want to make sure we're spending the people's money wisely, this is a good investment. This is an investment in our future to ensure that the economy is gets through the pandemic and we are able to recover much more quickly than if we allow this economy to go into a depression. And right now, if you look across the world at how countries across the world have handled the economic fallout from this pandemic, you will see that the United States' response to date has kept our economy in better shape than almost anywhere else in the world. So to say that experts agree, that's factually inaccurate. And to suggest that this is socialism for rich people, again, you know, in my district, people would not say that if you are helping people out between 75 and 99,000, and you know, by 99,000, you're getting zero, but at $75,000 a year, that those are not people that are categorizing themselves as rich people.
I want to ask you one final thing, because you've spoken against the partisanship of this era and about the possibility of more consensus governing. That's certainly a goal of President-elect Biden. And you've spoken about the importance of there being more women in Congress. And this year it was Republican women who saw a growth in their number of seats in the House. Is it possible that Democratic and Republican women will find consensus more than the men have? Or do you think party overrules that in this environment? And the idea that women can compromise more because you're more relationship oriented and less about winning than men and more about finding solutions, is that idea itself a gender stereotype?
That's interesting. In fact, I just had a Republican woman approach me on the floor of the House yesterday to say that she thinks the women need to get together. And we've certainly seen during the pandemic, it seems to be the countries led by women that have the best response to the pandemic and the crisis. But I do think there's probably something a little bit gendered about that, because I find that bipartisanship comes in all shapes and sizes. And really, what you have to focus on is where those areas are that you can agree on. And I have found that people have said to me over the last couple of years, is it even possible to really be bipartisan in these times? And I tell them the story of a gentleman who I sit on the House Armed Services Committee with. And every time he sort of, you know, gets ready to speak, I kind of tense up because I know I'm going to disagree. And I know I'm going to, and in some cases, you know, especially when it comes to issues and areas of sexual assault and harassment, I'm going to really disagree with him. And yet, I have co-sponsored bills with him because many of the issues in his district, economic issues, are similar to those in my district. So we find those pathways to working with people. I am very concerned because while I think it's incredibly hopeful that we have President Biden coming into office, and while I think Mitch McConnell is realizing how dangerous some of the ideology of the president is in his own caucus, as we see all of these members parting from him, I think I heard reports that he was supposed to have a conference call with Josh Hawley to talk about this vote on January 6th, and you know, Senator Hawley didn't even get on the phone. He didn't even have the respect to get on the phone with McConnell. So I think McConnell's realizing that. I will say, despite all that, so those are hopeful signs to me that we can get something done in this next administration. I do worry. I had some concerns just yesterday as we were getting sworn in with one member in particular who the sergeant at arms had to escort off the floor of the House because she refused to wear a mask. You know, those kind of weird issue areas that I wonder what some of our members, our new members in both the House and the Senate, what their focus will be. If they do have important policy discussions they want to have, if they do want to ensure that we're promoting our democracy, or if it is simply going to be about their personal power and their personal agenda that's going to be at the expense of our country.
Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill, Democrat from Northern New Jersey, good luck in your second term. We appreciate that you keep coming on with us.
Well, thank you for continuing to have me on, and have a great new year, and hopefully we'll talk soon. Thanks again.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.